LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
I imagine that right now you're feeling a bit like Alice, tumbling down the rabbit hole. I can see it in your eyes. You have the look of a man who accepts what he sees because he is expecting to wake up. Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life. That there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you want to know what it is?
This isn't real.
What is real? How do you define real? If you're talking about what you can feel, what you can smell, what you can taste and see, then real is simply electrical signals interpreted by your brain. What is real? How do you define real? 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 What is real?
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and today we present part two of our interview with Bernardo Kastrup discussing his book More Than Allegory on Religious Myth, Truth and Belief. If you're listening to this at LegalizeFreedom.com, you'll find a link to part one on this interview page. And if you're listening on YouTube or on a third party site, you can of course head over to LegalizeFreedom.com. That's legalize-freedom.com, and find both parts of this interview and many, many more by browsing the archive or using the search facility. The interview with Bernardo resumes as we ponder creation myths and the parallels between the Big Bang and the biblical Let There Be Light. With regard to creation myths, or however you like to put it, since I popped into this reality or existence, I've been thinking about where do we come from, all the rest of it, you know, is meaning and purpose. And I often thought that when I first read about the Big Bang, which of course is a theory, but ask your average Joe on the street about that, and if they know what it is, they'll be saying, oh, you know, this is what happened. This is how we came to be here. And I often thought, well, what's the difference between that and Let There Be Light? If you see what I mean. Let There Be Light, oh, that's absurd. What are you talking about? But Big Bang, you know, creation ex nihilo, either way you look at it, that's okay.
Yeah, it's essential for myths that they be plausible. Every culture that subscribed to a myth considered that myth plausible. The problem is that the criteria for plausibility change as cultures differentiate and evolve and change over time. So what one culture considers plausible, another one considers tremendously implausible. The Witoto think it's very plausible that Nainema spit the forest into existence, that it was divine saliva that grew into a forest. For them, this is completely plausible. For us, it's totally implausible. What is plausible for us is that 13.8 billion years ago, give or take, everything came out of nothing for no reason. That's what is plausible to us. this would be completely implausible for the Witoto. Actually, if they had psychiatric institutions, they would probably commit us. do you see what I mean? So, we are all talking about myths here, because the origin of everything is fundamentally transcendent. We are never going to wrap a literal narrative around it. We can wrap a literal narrative around what happened a peasant fraction of a second after that. But that origin in itself is unwrappable with a literal narrative. So we will always be talking about myths, whether they are plausible or not. There are other ways, though, to interpret even the symbolism behind the story of the Big Bang. I mean, what the Big Bang is telling us, it was meant as literal, but the human mind works in mysterious ways. What we think is literal may be actually be bubbling up from deeper parts of mind and pretending to be literal and giving our intellect permission to adopt it as literal, but it may actually embody much deeper intuitions. And I think that's the case of the Big Bang. Look at that imagery of a great explosion, a great expansion of a singularity into a very concrete, palpable and extended universe. This idea of turning something intangible into something not only concrete, but almost infinite. That is a highly symbolic idea. A great expansion in time and space, turning intangibility into concreteness. I propose that this is happening every moment, right now, not 13.8 billion years ago, but right now, at every single now, and there is only one now, of course, we are performing a cognitive Big Bang in our own minds. We are taking the intangibility of the present moment, this singularity, this intangible singularity of the present moment, and we are blowing it up into the stories of past and future, into a personal history and personal dreams and expectations. We are blowing up all this intangibility, extending it in time and space, and giving it concreteness. And we do it now, and now, and now, because there is only now. Everything outside the now is part of this cognitive Big Bang. And what is this cognitive Big Bang? It's a sort of mapping of the contents of experience across qualities that we associate with past and future. The past being things that are remote and definite, that can't be changed anymore. The future being things that are open, that entail many possibilities, that are not definite yet. But past and future exist only in so far as they are experienced in the now, with these qualities I just talked about. This cognitive Big Bang is just a distribution of the qualities of experience in the present moment that give us this notion that the intangibility of the now, this nothingness of the now, actually is a whole huge, infinite, totally concrete universe. It's magical what we are doing. It's a divine thing. And we are each doing it every time as we are talking right now. If you're looking for a miracle, there is one right there.
Just to backtrack on what you were saying a moment ago, this idea of plausibility in myth is really, really important. And this is why, of course, so many people find it easy to look at, religious myths, stories and accounts. And even though archaeology, for example, would tell us that there's no reason to take, for the sake of argument, everything in the Christian Bible and say that none of it was ever real, you know, because they found locations and what have you that tally in with that. But on the face of it, to an atheist, for example, it can all just sound ridiculous. Because of the language and the symbolism and the imagery that's deployed. A common trope, for example, in futuristic science fiction is quite often about what future societies might make of us and our stories and our society and how we did things and what we thought. And a very common way to go about it is to kind of do unto us what we do unto our predecessors, which is make everything sound a bit religious and distort it. So, for example, you might read a futuristic sci-fi book and it might take some of the common aspects of our daily lives and turn it into this bizarre story that we find quite amusing. Oh my God, yeah, they're talking about a television, but they thought it did this and it did that, but it didn't really, you know, and we didn't actually worship it. We just spent a lot of time sitting in front of it or whatever, you know. And it'd be really interesting to see what the, I don't know how religious we look in our materialism, you know, how religious that looks in 1,000 years from now.
Yeah, I think you see every generation always looks at past generations with this in a bit of a patronizing way. We look down at the past, and we sort of make previous worldviews look a bit ridiculous. It's our way of achieving meaning through self-esteem. So it's an understandable psychological process, and it will probably never end so long as we are humans. I think what makes our present worldview, the worldview that has evolved from the middle of the 19th century onwards, this neo-Darwinian materialist worldview, physicalist worldview, that Thomas Nagel talks about in his book Mind and Cosmos, and which I also talk about extensively in my own books, I think what makes this one particularly of notice is that it will be looked upon in the future not only as silly and naive and primitive, but as extremely harmful. So unlike the way we feel about the alchemists today, we think, they were silly, they were naive, but they were harmless. And you know, we smile, and if they were to pop in front of us today, we'd probably pat them in the back and say, oh, it's okay. No, I mean, you have no idea what you're doing, but it's all right. I think in our case, we will not be looked upon like this. We will be looked upon as the generation that almost destroyed the whole thing. As a particularly, if we don't destroy the whole thing, if we do, there will be nobody in the future to look back at us. That may be the best outcome. But if we somehow manage to pull through and survive this, I think people in the future will look back in a very sober way and think, my God, how did we allow that to happen? I mean, it will not be a pretty chapter in human history.
I think we've turned a corner already. I'm not quite sure when it happened, but probably fairly recently. You alluded to this earlier. You know, I mentioned earlier about people, you know, we have this innate craving for meaning, and religion was seen as something that was, I say, archaic, of the past. It was on the way out. People liked to quote, you know, how church attendance, you know, for example, has gone down, and yada, yada, yada. But I think one of the corner I'm referring to is actually the rise of religiosity that we're actually seeing now in the world. Now, of course, a lot of the manifestations of this are very negative indeed. And again, how sincere they are is another matter. But whether it's people reading self-help books or reading books about quantum physics and pondering what it might all mean, or whether it's people strapping explosives to themselves and crying Allah Akbar, I just think that they're kind of a neon golden age of pure science and pure rationality. I don't think we've ever had one. And I think you can see with some alarm now, people with that worldview kind of going, I can't, you know, we seem to be going backwards. But of course, that's just a matter of perspective. But I just think it's a function of this craving for meaning, which will manifest itself in good and bad ways and everything in between.
Yeah, just that, before I comment more on this, let me just make a sort of a caveat. Science itself, if it's done rigorously, it does not entail, imply, or encompass any form of philosophy. It doesn't entail a particular way of interpreting the underlying nature of reality. It's just the study and systematical modeling of the patterns and regularities of nature, whatever nature may be at an underlying level, at a fundamental level. So science itself is just a tool of modeling, a tool that allows us to know and predict that if A happens, then B follows. And if C happens, then D follows, and so on and so forth. It doesn't pass interpretation. It doesn't pass metaphysical or ontological interpretation onto this predictive models. It's just a set of predictive models that enables engineering and helps us live more effectively and sort of get more of a grip on nature. That's science. So I don't think science per se is a problem. I think, on the contrary, it's a fantastic tool. The problem is when people like Stephen Hawking and Krauss and other philosophically ignorant people forget that what they see as science is actually a philosophical overlay on top of science. And they don't see that. They think that it's pure science, so they denigrate philosophy. They say that philosophy is useless. While all along they are doing philosophy. They are passing an ontological, metaphysical interpretation onto the models of science. I think that is extremely harmful. It's an expression of profound ignorance. I would even say stupidity. Particularly so because they don't see what they are doing. So that, I think, is particularly bad about this day and age. Now, going back more specifically to your comment, Greg, I don't see a religious revival. What I see is a revival, or maybe a growth, of fundamentalism, which I don't see as religiosity at all. I see it as anti-religious. I see it as a way of flattening and abusing of religion, taking a shadow for the thing in itself, taking a square for the cube. I think that's what's growing. Religiosity is a way to relate to the intuitions of a myth that has absolutely nothing to do with dogmas and morals and instructions and particular ritualistic recipes. It's just a felt sense, a felt attunement, a felt connection to a set of images and symbols that establish a connection to something beyond what we can wrap in words. That's true religiosity, and that can happen whether you're going to church or not, whether you're a sinner or not, because morals are something we invented ourselves in order to control society. And true religiosity, I don't see a revival of that. What I do see is people desperately in search of that, a misguided search often, and they're trying to find replacements for that religiosity, true religiosity, which they've lost contact with. And I think you alluded to many of the ways in which that sort of quest for a replacement happens. But I do have a sense of a great loss of authentic, genuine religiosity. And I think that's a pity.
Well, I think that's what I meant when I said, you know, that it can manifest itself in different ways, that whether genuine or not, that there is something kind of happening. I still maintain that we feel that we've turned a corner, if you see what I mean, that there was a vision of humanity's future that is not going to play out, for better or worse. You know, that's just that I take on board all the points that you've just made, absolutely. But for some people, you know, not in the fundamentalist sense, but for some people, this reaching around for things is coming from a place, probably, you know, I'd say unconscious, but it's, you know, it's not coming from a bad place, that they're just looking for something. They're looking for meaning, and it's manifested itself in certain ways. It could even be as simple as, you know, buying an even bigger television or buying a new car or whatever. You know, they're looking for something beyond just the idea that they're, you know, that life means nothing and after death there is nothing.
Absolutely. The search for, the word for this is numinosity, I think. It's the word that Jung used to use. The numinous as an expression of transcendence in an object or a person or an event in the empirical world. The search for numinosity is underlying everything. Well, not perhaps not everything, but maybe almost everything we do. Even that big TV, even the romantic partner and the sexual encounter. These are ways in which we try to find the numinous. But yes, it's becoming more and more difficult to find the numinous. We may even find the numinous in a bottle of alcohol. Or in a suicide terrorist attack. There are many dangerous ways of looking for the numinous. Because you see, at bottom, reality is not good or bad, evil or godly. I mean, reality is what is. And its expression is everything we see in the world. It's all encompassing. We can't reject anything because we don't like it, because we think it's sinful or it's bad or it's destructive. All those things that are sinful, bad and destructive and evil, they're also part of reality. And the proof of it is that they exist. The fact that they exist show that they are a manifestation of whatever it is that underlies the world, underlies the real facts, objects, and phenomena of the world. So a true religious view has to be all-encompassing, and most of the traditional religions are all-encompassing in very subtle ways. Even Christianity has heaven, hell, and purgatory in between. The devil in Christianity was an archangel, also a son of God. He was actually a member of the court of God, right, in the Old Testament. He was the prosecutor. He was a helper of God. So even Christianity will encompass all these polarities, in maybe even less than subtle ways.
Okay, well, we've mentioned already some of our concepts governing reality. We talked about quantum mechanics. We've mentioned Einstein and relativity. I mean, time and space themselves become up for grabs here at a certain point. I'm not even sure whether to touch upon this because it's so vast, but this is a central, again, plank of your thesis. If reality, you know, if all is within mind, then so too are, you know, the so-called laws of nature and, you know, physics, gravity, just the whole nine yards, really, it all becomes a mental construct.
Yeah, including time and space. What are time and space but qualities of experience? Experienced in the now. And the now is the eternity, right? The eternal now. The eternity is not something that happens in the future and then forever. And that's not eternity. That's the future. Eternity is the now that never leaves. And what is time and space that seem to extend the now, but qualities of experience that are experienced in the now? And what gives form to time and space are myths, which sort of wraps back to the previous subject. Time and space are generated by stories playing in the back of our minds constantly about where we've been, where we are, and where we are going to, what has happened, what is happening, and what may be going to happen. So even time and space has to be enfolded in this notion that all is in mind. And the way to do that is to realize that time and space are particular qualities of present experience. And of course, the laws of nature are also in mind. So what are the laws of nature according to this notion that all reality is in mind? They are the expression of the patterns and regularities according to which mind expresses itself. The whole of nature are excitations of mind / consciousness. I use the words mind and consciousness interchangeably here. Reality, the world, are the patterns and regularities of the excitations of mind. And we are dissociated segments of that mind, looking at itself as a person looks in the mirror.
I woke up one day actually with this idea in my head that time didn't exist. And I remember thinking it's a bit early to be thinking about that sort of thing. But I then started to think about, you know, because it's a popular notion at the moment. People talk about being present, living in the present, living in the moment. There is only now. And even if you take that as metaphorical, it's telling us something important, which is about focus on where you are and that the past and the future don't exist. Take that very pragmatic, very practical as a guide for living. But if you start thinking about it in metaphysical terms, it's like, okay, well, what is the present moment? I remember asking myself this question. It was like, well, it's now, but oh, it's gone. You know, and the time it takes me to say now, how long is that? You know, a second. And then I start thinking, well, a second. Okay, what's that? That's arbitrary division, subdivision of time, so-called, that we've come up with. So, okay, let's start whittling it down. What do we know? What can we talk about in terms that the average guy on the street can comprehend? A microsecond, a nanosecond. And then I thought, well, is there any reason to stop salami slicing this unit of time? Well, no, there isn't. Why would we stop? Because we don't have a word for that infinitesimally small amount of time. We'll just invent a new word, you know, call it a cheeseburger second, whatever you like, you know, just keep whittling. And then I thought, well, that then made me think about Planck length. you know, in terms of quantum mechanics. What's the word? It's sort of an event horizon, I suppose, beyond which we cannot go. But there's no reason that there shouldn't be something beyond that. So that just led me to, it's a very roundabout way of, that led me to ponder what the present moment actually is, and then the nature of time. And I just thought, well, there's no reason to stop cutting this unit of time down and down. And then where does that end up? Is there an end to that? You know?
Well, theoretically, it ends at the Planck time. If I put the physicist's hat now, I would say there are good reasons to think that it ends there at Planck time, in the sense that in a space of time smaller than that, nothing can change. There is no time for anything to change. And so there is a quantization at that level as well, which is a consequence of the quantum approach to reality. But the way to think about it, I think, and that's what I elaborate on in the book, one is to keep in mind that a Planck time is an abstraction. It's a theoretical abstraction. And it's zero followed by more than 30 zeros and then some numbers after that. So it is intangibly small. It is so small that it is impossible to imagine how small it is. In other words, it is well within the realm of pure abstraction, completely outside experience. The moment this happens, the moment it becomes pure abstraction, fundamentally beyond anything within the scope of experience, that's the moment when it becomes a symbol. Because that's what the symbol is. It's something that you cannot grasp concretely in front of you right now. It's beyond your immediate experience. It's pointing at something deeper than your immediate self-reflective experience. Planck time, from this perspective, just like the Big Bang, is a symbol. But now the question is, what is it a symbol of? It's a symbol of the intangibility of the present moment. There is this Buddhist saying, the Heart Sutra, about emptiness being everything and everything being emptiness. I can't remember exactly what the quote is, but the way I interpret it is to see the present moment as this intangible singularity, which is basically empty, because it's not long enough for there to be anything in there. It's empty. It's a singularity. But at the same time, within this present moment is everything, because there is nothing but the present moment. So everything arises out of this emptiness through a magic trick. And in the book, I call that magic trick the cognitive Big Bang. In other words, it's a myth-making magic trick. We wrap a myth around this nothing, this intangible singularity that is the present moment. We wrap a myth around it, and by magic, that myth creates past, present, and future, and brings concreteness to that profound intangibility. It creates everything out of nothing. And we are the ones performing this magic trick at every single moment.
Returning to the idea of dreaming that we touched upon earlier on and reality, there's been endless stories, mythologies down the eons that have hinted at a dreamlike nature for what we call reality. Of course, we dream up worlds, universes every night, you know, when we go to sleep. Whether we remember them when we wake is another matter. And people have always made very firm distinctions between the dream world and the real world, so-called. But it seems to me that, and again, this is something that was a light bulb moment repeatedly for me when I was reading your book, that this, what you and I are experiencing now, that the reality in which we're speaking to each other is real because, to pick up the point you made earlier about God awakening within his own dream, that, you know, we're awake, we're lucid in this dream. I love the idea that you presented in the book about that dreaming itself might have a function to remind us of this. And I'll just add on a little thought at the end of my comment that I have met, I don't know if you've done this, but I have met figures in my own dreams, and I have told them that this is a dream, because for some level I was aware I was dreaming. I said, you know, this is a dream. And they've actually been really offended. They've just said, get out of here, you're insane, what are you talking about?
You know, I think this brings many ideas to mind. I'll try to comment on the most important ones. Going back to myths, in the West we have the myth of Hermeticism, the Hermetic tradition in the West. And one of the tenets of that myth is this notion of so above as below, or as above, so below, something like that. And the basic idea is that the universe, creation, is fractal. In other words, that parts of creation look like the whole of creation, and subparts of these parts look like the part. That the same theme sort of unravels in a self-similar way across levels, across scales. And what is striking about fractals is that it is a very neat, very economic and elegant way of creating infinite complexity from what is, in principle, a very, very simple idea. And that's what fractals are. It's a very simple idea that, when applied recursively to itself, creates unending complexity, unending beauty, unending patterns and colors, and then all kinds of qualities. Anybody with any experience with fractals will know what I'm referring to. So it seems strikingly plausible that creation itself would be based on a fractal, because it is the most economic way of generating infinite complexity from a very simple idea, from a very simple thought in mind, as would the idealist interpretation entail. But the thing is, if the universe is created this way, if it is fractal at that fundamental level, then self-similarity applies. In other words, small parts of it will express or manifest the same patterns and regularities as the whole of it. And now I will link back to the question you asked. If the universe as a whole is a dream in the mind of God, then the fact that we, down there, down the levels of that fractal, also dream, may be a fractal reflection, a reflection of the self-similarity between God dreaming in us. We dreaming may be a reflection of the process that creates the whole of reality to begin with. Our dreaming may be a small fractal reflection of the process that set the whole thing in motion, and it's maintaining the existence of the universe right now. So I sympathize with this intuition you had, that our own dreams are sort of hints built right into the structure of reality, hints of what reality itself is.
There's another aspect to this which I really enjoyed in the book as a thought exercise, if nothing else. A perspective you present is this idea that, you know, if you want to know the mind of God, look around, and you're thinking about our perspective, you know, our perceptions from, you know, where we are versus this mind at large, to use the term that you borrow from Huxley. That is to say that the awareness of mind at large would be different from these kind of collapsed, individuated units of consciousness that we are, and that in itself is very valuable. So I suppose the way to sum it up is, I think it's the phrase you use is something like that we know what God cannot know simply from our perspective. So in that sense, this goes back to another idea that I've read on and off over the years about we are the universe becoming aware of itself. And that's kind of, that seemed to resonate in some kind of meaningful way, and that fits in with what you're saying.
Yeah, maybe I can use two metaphors for this, and so people can try to feel what the common ground is between the two metaphors. One is the one I use in the book, this idea that in part three I tell a cosmogonic myth, a myth of the origin of the universe and how things turned up to be what they are today. And there, the story is that it all began as a dream in the mind of God. We use the G word here, metaphorically or symbolically, rather. God began dreaming and sort of fell in love with his own dream. But he was still dreaming from a sort of a outside-in perspective, like we entertain daydreams and fantasies. We know that the dream is within us, not us within the dream. Imagination, if you will. And he fell in love with his own, or when I say his, sort of borrowing from the Christian tradition, but I don't see God as gendered. Let me just make this point. It could be her as well.
Yes.
So I would say she and her now, just to make a point. So she fell in love with her own imagination and then popped into her own dream and acquired then an inside out perspective. Now she could experience the dream from within as opposed to from without. Now she was in the dream as opposed to the dream being in her. And what popped in was a dissociated aspect of the mind of God. And that inside out perspective gives God a symbolic view of God's own cognitive activity, of God's own mentation, so to say. And this symbolic view from the inside out is not available to God herself. God doesn't see the symbols of what she is thinking and feeling and manifesting in mind. We do. So an example I use, I'm describing the myth that I tell in the book, and I don't mean these things literally. In the book, I mentioned the example of the sun. Like, we experience the sun, this glowing, beautiful glowing ball of ionized gas, putting out tremendous amounts of energy and ruling the sky. God doesn't see the sun. God sees the emotions and thoughts whose symbolic representation is what we call the sun. And whatever those emotions and thoughts are, they are inaccessible to us as much as the sun we perceive and experience is inaccessible to God from an outside-in perspective. And it is the complementarity between these two views, the direct phenomenal view of the thoughts and emotions in the mind of God, and the symbolic view in the screen of perception that we have, it is this complementarity between the two where the magic happens, where the alchemy happens.
Okay, well, just extending this idea then about, in terms that we can all kind of grasp, the idea of our waking reality actually being having these dreamlike qualities. And if we think about ourselves as the sort of condensed clusters of consciousness that we've referred to a few times now, what does that say, or how does that relate to the aforementioned laws of physics and those that govern or seem to govern our physical reality? Because we hear a lot these days, again, it's another popular trope about, you know, we create our own reality, yada, yada, yada. What does this say about our ability to affect or otherwise these parameters of reality? Like, you know, you and I can't decide to just jump off a building and fly. Apparently, it won't work. We're going to fall to the ground. So we seem to have limited control over this.
The difficulty of the question lies in the we. What do we mean by we? What do we mean by I? There are many levels of I. There is the I of the ego. There is the I of the unconscious mind. There is the I of unconscious cerebration. I don't think anything is unconscious. I'm just making a concession to the word that is normally used in the language. There are many I's. There is this book called Incognito by David Eagleman, in which he basically says that we are actually many. We are a committee of different eyes vying for control and attention. If we are talking about the eye as the ego, that part of the mind that we ordinarily identify with, that part where our conscious volition resides, our self-reflective volition resides, that I has absolutely no control over the laws of nature. I think that's an undeniable empirical fact that takes significant amounts of wishful thinking to ignore. We cannot change the laws of nature. We, meaning our ego, cannot change the laws of nature. Period. I wish it were different. We would all be very happy tyrants if things were different. But nature is what, I mean, happy tyrants, we may start warring against each other because our view about what the universe should be, what the laws of nature should be, would inevitably contradict each other. But that's not the case. We don't have that problem. The laws of nature are completely independent from our egoic volition. So that we has no control. over what's going on. But now the question is, are we really the ego? Or is there a deeper aspect, maybe even deeper aspects of ourselves, well below and transcendent from the point of view of the ego? You see, if the myths are right, then, and we are dissociated aspects of a deity that entered the deity's dream, then at the most fundamental level, we are the deity. And at that level, the laws of nature are what they are because we made them be as they are. But this we that set the laws of nature in motion is not the we of the ego. For all practical purposes, it's not really the we mean when we use the word we in the cultural discourse or talking to each other. It's a much deeper we, which embodies a set of beliefs, a set of expectations about what should be the consequence of this and that event, how one thing connects to another as they unfold in the natural order of things, holds a set of beliefs about this pattern of this causal lines, these sequences of cause and effect, which are reflections of beliefs and expectations of a much, much deeper aspect of the we. It's still we, but at a much deeper level, beyond what our cultural discourse considers the we to be. So from that perspective, the world that we see around us, and that's the myth in part 3 of the book, the world we see around us is a symbolic representation of very deeply ingrained beliefs in our minds. Our, meaning our deeper minds, not the minds of our egos, a mind that transcends even our species. At that level of mind, the mind of a man is the same as the mind of a mosquito, and is the same as the mind of an amoeba or a plant. All those minds are one at that level because they haven't yet differentiated from each other. And it is beliefs and expectations at that non-differentiated level that we see in symbolic form, in the form of the laws of nature.
Yeah, you've written the book in three parts, actually, as you've just referred to. Part three being in the form of a fictionalized story. Why did you choose to present those ideas in that way? Why did you feel that was necessary?
I would call it a mythologized story as opposed to a fictionalized story.
Because Yeah.
Fiction sort of entails that it's not true. And I am not saying that it's not true. I'm saying it's mythical. It's a mythologized story. Well, it's a book about religious myths, Greg. So in a sense, the theme of the book comes back at many different levels. In part one, I talk directly about religious myths. In part two, I talk about time and space and how religious myths create time and space. And in part three, I use a myth in order to convey an idea about the nature of reality. So it seemed only appropriate to use a myth. And it happened to be convenient as well. It was just more straightforward and direct for me to write it in mythologized form. But I don't want to explain why. I'll just leave it out there.
No, that's fine. I'd rather thought, perhaps at this stage of our talk, that I might be able to bring this thing together, you know, a few obvious threads to tie things up. But I feel actually like, in the best possible sense, that we're going the wrong way down a funnel. That is to say, you know, that things open out and they continue to open out into even broader vistas. And I've got no idea what to do next. So I'm just going to go with whatever pops into my head as we, you know, enter the final stages here. So along picking up some of the threads of what we have discussed, might there be a single cosmic consciousness in that case? You know, might literally at some level, might you and I be each other, if you see what I mean?
I've arrived at this conclusion from several different paths, so to say, and they all lead to Rome. One has been a very analytical, very rigorous path along the lines of, you know, analytic philosophy based on argumentations driven by things like ontological parsimony, logical consistency, empirical honesty, and have arrived at this conclusion that reality can be reduced to only one ontological primitive, and that one ontological primitive is a form of universal consciousness whose excitations, whose patterns of excitation constitute all reality. And we are just dissociated alters of that universal consciousness. So I've arrived at this conclusion from the analytic path first. And the story behind this book we are talking about today is my discovery that the religious myths of the world tend to point, it's not, they are not consistent. There is a plethora of myths out there. But by and large, the big myths, they all point to that same conclusion, that there is only one consciousness. They call it God or Nainema or Karora or Brahman or the Godhead. There is thousands of names. But the meaning and the connotation seems to be the same. This unity thing behind all reality that is associated with consciousness, with phenomenality, to use the technical philosophical word, and we being aspects, dissociated aspects of that one consciousness. And it was striking to me to see this in religious myths. It has rekindled in me a deeper respect for religious myths, for true religiosity, in the sense that, hey, people could sense intuitively, almost perceive with the imagination, if you know what I mean. They could perceive with the imagination a very deep truth that has taken at least me years of hardcore analytical work and thinking, you know, a lot of steps in reasoning to arrive at a precariously similar and much less rich conclusion, but in the same direction, completely consistent with what the myths are indicating. And the myths are even much richer than the philosophical/analytical conclusion. So yeah, that opened some new perspectives for me.
You had a moment, shall we say, in Cologne Cathedral, didn't you, which you relate in the book?
Yeah, that's true. It was an unexpected epiphany. I grew up being influenced a lot by my father, from some scientific influence in my life, very rational, reason-based, empirically driven. But I was also influenced by my mother, who is a Roman Catholic, and has what I call genuine religiosity. You know, has this attunement, this connection with the transcendent aspect of a myth that is completely beyond morals and rules of behavior and the hierarchies of institutions and all that stuff. But I sort of neglected and ignored that influence, that religious influence, from very early on. I went to university very early. I had just completed 17, and I found myself, you know, in the bastion of physicalism at the university, worked in major scientific institutions. So religion sort of fell through the cracks, and I disregarded it very early in my teens. And I kept on going to churches because I have this fascination, or at least I told myself that I had this fascination with the architecture of European medieval churches, medieval cathedrals, Gothic cathedrals, Baroque cathedrals, you know, going back hundreds of years. There are many in Europe. So it's an inexhaustible source of enjoyment if you happen to live in Europe. And so I was going to churches for this reason. At least that's what I told myself at a self-reflective level, that I liked the architecture, I liked the vibe of the place. And I was in Cologne's Cathedral, which I think is Europe's second largest church. Only St. Peter's Basilica is bigger in Rome, in the Vatican. And I was looking at the figure of the Christ behind the shrine of the Three Kings. And I can't describe what happened because, again, it's beyond words. And the way to point at it is the Christian myth, which everybody already knows. So what am I to say? But just to give a suggestion, it dawned on me that the man hanging from that cross in a depiction of great sacrifice, and the cross being this intersection of a vertical bar and a horizontal bar, the epiphany had to do, it's not what I'm going to say, but it had something to do with what I'm going to say. I'm going to do my best. It had to do with the fact that the man hanging from that cross is each one of us. We are all nailed to the cross of space and time, vertical and horizontal, that we conceptualize ourselves. And that insight, that epiphany, is behind what I try to articulate in the book when I describe the cognitive Big Bang in part two. It's this notion that the man in the cross is each one of us. Each one of us is actually an expression of the mind that is dreaming reality and the whole world into existence. And it creates the world by conceptualizing space and time, which then become a cross of limited transcendence. By constraining us within a particular segment of space and time and making us feel that we are finite. So that cross is that, on the one hand, the instrument through which the concreteness and extension of the world is created. And on the other hand, the source of all of our suffering as well. And these two go hand in hand. They are intimately interconnected to the point that they actually only one thing that can be just seen from two different perspectives. That's the best I can do to try to verbalize the epiphany. But of course, as something that transcends words, it was much more and different than what I just explained.
If you come to England, you should come here to York. I found myself completely unexpectedly working in the minster here, the Gothic cathedral, and just to be in the space itself. I think a lot of people who are there take it for granted; they don't think about it. But for me, it's like being inside one of our metaphors. If you see what I mean, it's just symbolism is dripping everywhere, yeah. Everywhere that you look. And it occurred to me that the people who conceived these places and who built them in some ways were living in a different world than the one that we do. Their consciousness was different.
Oh yeah, completely. We don't have access to that. We can only imagine. But I think they lived in a very different world. Things that we take as hypotheses, they took to be obvious facts. And in a sense, there is a sense in which they were more correct than we are today. But for me, Greg, I think the consequence of these epiphanies over the past few years that eventually led me to write this book was that I've come to a point in my intellectual development where I can sincerely and honestly give myself intellectual permission to embrace religious symbolism again. Not because I think reason has failed me. On the contrary, because I think I've brought reason to a point where a natural implication of reason is to recognize its own boundaries and to recognize that existence extends beyond its own boundaries and therefore to give legitimacy to religious symbology. So that has been my journey.
Okay, well, this might be coming from very much a narrow perspective of myself as a, you know, collapsed unit of consciousness and the sort of thinking that, you know, the linear thinking that we all undergo. But in terms of our overall concept here, so we might have speculated about the origin of everything, but this is the question. It's the whole, what did God do before he invented the universe? What happened before the Big Bang? We have the origin of everything, but what about the source of origin?
You know, I'll give you a technical answer because I do think it's the best answer. The game of explanation is always to explain one thing in terms of another. Every explanation you give has to have raw materials. You explain things in terms of other things. And then you try to explain these other things in terms of yet other things. In other words, you explain one thing in terms of another and that in terms of another and another and another. But you can't keep on playing this game forever. There is a point where you hit rock bottom and you have to say, okay, now I explain this in terms of that, and that has no explanation because there is nothing else in terms of which to explain it. Technically, we say it's non-reducible. It's an ontological primitive. Every explanation of nature has to have at least one ontological primitive, one ultimate, there are many names for it, one fundamental aspect that cannot be explained, that simply is. And I think God or mind at large or universal consciousness or Brahman or Karora, Nainema, whatever name we give to it, is the ontological primitive. So to describe it, we have to describe it indirectly. We have to say, God is that whose manifestation is the world. Or, universal consciousness is that whose excitations are the empirical world. Know what I mean? Is that that which, and then you say something. But what is the intrinsic nature of God in and of itself? What is the intrinsic nature of cosmic consciousness in and of itself? We can't say, because there is nothing in terms of which to say it. It simply is. And that thing, that ultimate, that ontological primitive that simply is what we are. Everything else are the contents of our consciousness. Even our own bodies are a set of feelings, sights, perceptions that we project our identity onto. But even our bodies unfold in the screen of our perceptions. That which observes the screen of our perceptions, that which observes and feels the body, that which is a witness to everything, that is the ultimate. That is the irreducible aspect of reality. And we are it.
Yeah, I think it just reminds me that the perspective we're coming from is thinking in terms of like time and space. You know, that there has to be something before or after or even during. And it occurred to me, even thinking in terms of fairly conventional cosmology, that recently I've been entertaining the idea that there has always been something. Didn't maybe go beyond that intellectually, but in trying to come to terms with the idea of like, well, what was before that and what was before that, to get round it, just to say, okay, well, how about we allow there's always been something and then move forward from there?
It's still time-based.
Yeah.
That which you are, that which cannot be explained in terms of anything else, that which is observing the dance of existence, that is thinking time and space into existence. So, of course, that thing in itself, which is conceiving time and space into existence, cannot be bound by time and space.
Bernardo, today we've been discussing your latest book, which is entitled More Than Allegory, On Religious Myth, Truth and Belief. And to be honest with you, I said to you earlier off air, you know, this has like been a real game changer for me. I've not read anything quite like this. And I suppose you can have an idea put in front of you and like, you know, a conveyor belt, and you can, the same idea can come by again. And then there comes a time perhaps when you see it differently. How can I put it? You know, a little bit like the geometric kind of analogies you use in your book with the diagrams, you know, how something can appear different from a certain angle. And this book for me has been a bit like waking up in the Matrix sort of thing, which is kind of like, okay, I know I'm still in it, but everything kind of looks different. You know, everything has like a slightly different texture and things. I said perspective shifter. There's no question about it.
I know what you mean. I'm glad it has had this effect on you, Greg. I'm very glad. That was my goal with the book.
So I do wonder, though, sometimes, because I've seen it, we see this happening with the human race down the eons, sometimes that people have the meaning of life set in front of them on a plate with a knife and fork either side, and they still kind of reject it, if you see what I mean. You know, it's kind of like, this is what it's all about. And people are kind of like, well, yeah, next, if you see what I mean. You know,
I'm sure this is happening. I mean, the answers we are looking for are being paraded in front of us every day, right? It's a question of when we are ready to see, when the ego is ready to see, not the availability of the answer. The answer's right there, has been for thousands of years. It's just about our readiness to recognize it.
Exactly, exactly. I think the phrase I used earlier was, you kind of see what you look for, and I find that, I guess we call them synchronicity sometimes, that the more awareness I bring to these things, if you see what I mean, the more I look, the more I see. And even from putting your book down a couple of days ago, it's kind of like I see more now because, you know, I'm looking for it, if you see what I mean.
I think I know what you mean. Yeah, I'm happy to hear it. It validates all the effort, Greg.
Okay, well, Bernardo, we've skated around all sorts of issues in your book and arising from it, and we haven't even scratched the surface. That's just the nature of these topics. I'd urge people to pick the book up and make of it what they will. In the meantime, perhaps you'd like to tell folks about your website. I mean, the book's available everywhere. That's easy to get. But tell folks about your website and anything else you want to share.
So the website is bernardocastrup.com. That's Bernard with an O and then Kastrup with a K, Kastrup.com. And from there are links to everything. There are links to the books, to my Facebook page, to my YouTube channel, where I keep several videos and I keep on making new ones every now and then. My Twitter account, to a discussion forum where people talk about the ideas in my books. So that's the launch pad for everything else.
Okay, well, let's leave people with a thought of that lovely quote in your book from Ralph Hodgson. Some things have to be believed to be seen.
There you go.
Well, Bernardo, thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
It was a pleasure, Greg. I didn't even feel the time pass. Thanks for having me again.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.